Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. They watched the 1996 movie Scream over and over again. One of the boys was truly infatuated with the movie and wanted to be part of it. He, along with his two friends, lured two teenage girls to a local park in Salem, New Hampshire, late one night where the girls were brutally murdered by being stabbed over and over again. Read how they were tracked to Michigan from New Hampshire and how they were brought finally to justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder by the Bathhouse Door, the true story of the murder of two teenage girls by three boys who wanted to play Scream, with my special guest, author John Tomasi. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, John Tomasi.
Hi, Dan. How you doing? And thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this book, Murder by the Bathhouse Door.
Thank you.
Let's talk about, as you write in the book, Fall 1984. Tell us your position professionally, your teaching position, and your profession police-wise, law enforcement-wise.
Okay, I had just been promoted to sergeant in 1983 in the Salem Police Department. I was the patrol sergeant on the 5-to-1 shift. I had started teaching in 1981. I was teaching at that time Northern Essex Community College. I started in the business department, and in 1984, they had lost a couple of criminal justice instructors and asked me if I could transition to CJ. So I was teaching two courses at Northern Essex. They were intro to criminology and police in a modern society. And I was teaching, like I said, I was teaching part-time.
You, one of your lectures you spoke about was serial killers, and you talked about whether they were generally sociopaths or psychopaths, where not all psychopaths are serial killers. But the thing that was a commonality was the lack of conscience. And you attributed this to your undergraduate major was behavioral psychology at the University of New Hampshire.
That's correct. I got that in 1970s, and I went on to get an MBA. I've got to tell you, in police work, psychology was a really good major to have. And one of the things we talked about was serial killers, and sociopaths and psychopaths have a lot in common. Probably the biggest difference is a psychopath doesn't have a conscience and could be very charming and alluring. Ted Bundy was a perfect example of that. Also very intelligent. Ted was going for his law degree. And I think this was very much the case with the boys involved here, especially Eric Jalinowski.
Let's get to these three boys in this story. You take us to August 1997, and six people living in a Motel 6 motel room in Leominster, Massachusetts, and three friends. So introduce the three friends that are there, and also the fourth, Jacob Romero, and tell us the situation they have themselves there in this motel? And under what circumstances do they find themselves there?
These were 18 and 19 year old boys who didn't really have a steady job. James Grant, one of the three boys, had just lost his job for theft. He had stolen $500, and that's how they were able to afford the motel room. I think at that time, Motel 6 was only charging $35 or $40 a night. Eric Jelinuski had just gotten out of the Army earlier that spring, and he was scheduled for advanced infantry training in September, October. So they were just floating from place to place. And in this hotel room, they had another friend who was there, Jacob Romero, who had nothing to do with the murders. But a couple girls came and went too over those 10 days they were there. And while they were there, they lived off essentially theft. They would steal gasoline. They would steal food from grocery stores. And they, especially Eric Jelinuski, were on drugs. His drugs of choice were cocaine and meth and occasionally marijuana to come down from his highs. But he, right. One of the things is he watched the 1996 movie Scream over and over and over again, along with Scarface. And he knew pretty much all the lines by heart. By around the sixth, seventh day, as the movie is playing, he'd be saying the lines along with the movie. The other kids watched the movie too several times, but nowhere near as much as Jelinuski.
You write about a specific scene in the movie Scream that Eric Jelinuski especially appreciated. What was that one scene?
That was the scene when they stabbed one of their victims and tasted the blood, or made like they were tasting the blood. He wanted to do that. And at one point in the future, Doucette, in fact, did do it, who was the third person there. Chris Doucette, James Grant, and Eric Jelinuski were the three boys.
Let's get back to this motel. They exit this motel in 10 days. They run out of money. And the three boys go one way and Jacob Romero another. And as you say, that Eric had watched this over and over again, estimated 20 times while at the motel. Now, let's get to, as you write, the murders, Saturday, September 13th, 1997, in Salem. And this is the day, anyway, that Dorothy Myers was out walking her dog when she spotted a girl lying on the ground about 40 feet from the road in Salem. Tell us, what is the condition of the woman that's found by police, and how do police proceed?
Well, she was found at Hedgehog Park. Hedgehog Park has a little pond there called Hedgehog Pond, and it was frequented by pretty much everyone. Late at night, it was frequented a lot by juveniles, young adults. And it's about 6:30 in the morning. It's a chilly morning, and she's walking her dog, and about 30 feet off the road, she sees a body of a girl, and the girl isn't moving. She didn't get any closer. It didn't look natural to her. So she ran across the street to, I believe it was Clem's Variety, and they called the police station. Two officers went down, Bucky Melissus and John Lazowski, and discovered that she was, in fact, dead. Full lividity had set in. She was very cold to the touch, and she was in a pool of blood. So it was evident it was a murder scene. They immediately secured the scene and called for more people in addition to the Attorney General's office. In the state of New Hampshire, whenever there's a murder, the Attorney General's office is contacted and they pretty much run or direct the investigation.
And that person's Pat Donovan, and you introduce him as this central character in this investigation and this story, obviously.
Right. Pat used to be a prosecutor for the Salem Police Department for several years, very well-liked and highly respected. From there, he went on to a private practice with a friend of his, and he was originally picked for the attorney general's position or assistant attorney general. He is currently sitting on the New Hampshire Supreme Court. So Pat is very highly respected and very competent.
You also introduced the state medical examiner, Thomas Andrew, but also senior detective Paul Marchand arrives, also Kevin Swift, along with Roger Boudet.
Roger Boudet, that's correct.
And these guys you write are all 20-year veteran detectives, all highly decorated. And you say that Detective Marchand immediately decides to check out the nearby bathhouse. on the western side of the pond, about 70, 80 yards from the body. What does he discover at the bathhouse?
That's correct. Paul has unbelievable instincts. He's by the bathhouse door and he sees another body. There's a fireplace with a large hearth in it, and this is where he found the body. The body was not only stabbed multiple times, but looked like part of her head was caved in. And this turned out to be the case, that Eric Jalinowski had stabbed her multiple times. This was Kimberly Farah, and she was gurgling. And he ended up grabbing her and bashing her head against the fireside hearth.
Police find Marchand and Swift, and the others find a fingerprint in blood. Where is this fingerprint found?
It's on her leg, Kimberly Farah's leg. What we found out that Jalinowski did later on was he physically dragged the body, and it was Jalinowski's fingerprint.
Now, how do police proceed with this in terms of determining any kind of suspects other than securing this crime scene and sending in forensic and doing the usual parts of the investigation they do? What is the first thing they do?
Well, they ended up securing the scene, started a search party, and the search was expanded the next day, and they didn't really find anything. However, what was interesting was they had stolen Kimberly Farah's car. The three boys and two girls, Kimberly Farah and Leanne Milius, along with Eric Jalinowski, James Grant, and Chris Doucette, went to the park that night. They were drinking beers, and they were just partying until they decided to kill them, which was probably shortly after midnight. We were contacted by Oxford police. They had Kimberly's car was put out as stolen, and Oxford police had already found it, and then they got the hit on NCIC, the National Crime Information Center. They contacted us and Roger Baudet and Paul Marchand, and once they processed the scene along with the state police crime lab, they ended up going down to Oxford and seeing the car.
Now, tell us about the state of the car, what these boys had attempted, but we might have missed that there was a discovery of a wallet at the bathhouse.
Yeah, that's correct. I'd like to say we discovered who they were by really fantastic police work, which that was there, but it was a lot of stupidity on behalf of the boys. They had Eric Jalinowski's car plus Kimberly's car, and they were going to drive out to Michigan, close to the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. Chris Doucette was there originally, and his mom lived there up in Manton, Michigan. So when they found Kimberly's car, the boys had tried to torch it. There was a rag that was soaked in lighter fluid. They stuck it in the gas tank, the gas cap, and lit it on fire and then took off. We were able to ascertain this later by James Grant's confession. So the car didn't burn. However, Roger Baudet, they started doing a very cursory search of the car, and they found a wallet in the back, and the wallet belonged to Chris Doucette. They were able to track down that Chris Doucette was from Michigan. He had a prior record. He did spend some time in jail for breaking and entering and malicious damage of a high school. And from Chris's mother, we were able to ascertain the other two friends, James Grant and Eric Jalinowski. As it turned out, Eric Jalinowski's mother worked at Fort Devens, and we were able to get a lot of information about the three boys from her.
What did she say about the boys? What was their behavior like? What did they do when they got to her house? What did she know? What did she tell them?
What was interesting that Eric Jalinowski's mother said was, Chris is a good boy, but he doesn't have a conscience. Which when Mark Kavanaugh, who was also a detective assigned to the investigation, he had interviewed Jalinowski's mother. I said, wow, that's classic psychopath. So they made it out to Manton, Michigan, to Chris Doucette's mother, and they spent the night in the car because she didn't want them in the house. She had previously been contacted by Salem police and county sheriff, Detective Sergeant Dan O'Reilly from Michigan. And they said, you know, we're looking at your boys. We expect them to come to your house, and they're wanted for questioning in a murder investigation. So at that point, she did feed him, gave him sandwiches and food, but they had to sleep in the car that night. Early the next morning, before she got up, the boys left and went further inland. They were looking for a house to break into.
Let's go back a second to the medical examiner's autopsy. What does he determine about the nature of the stab wounds and the killers?
This was interesting because he saw three different stab wounds. He saw the stab wounds on Kimberly's body were with a lot of anger and a lot of thrust. They went very deep. The stab wounds on Leanne's body, some of them were very superficial, more like slashes that did break the skin but didn't penetrate deep. And there were others that were deep, but not as deep or as what he said was vicious as those on Kimberly's body. So we were looking at two or three. At that point, we knew that we're quite possibly looking at two or three different assailants.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the search for these three killers. Or there are three suspects, but some really good suspects they are. So they speak to Mary Wallace, and Mary Wallace tells them a few things about the motel stay and sort of the relationship that the girls have with the boys. Tell us what Mary Wallace has to say.
Well, James Grant had dated Leanne earlier in that summer. Leanne had a friend from Fitchburg who she went down to visit, and James was from Fitchburg, and they went out several times, and Leanne didn't like James as much as James did. James wanted a romantic relationship. Leanne just wanted it as a friend. But it appeared that weekend when the boys were up that Friday, Leanne was attracted more to Chris Doucette and Kimberly to Eric Jelinuski.
Now, soon some crime scenes or scenes related to the crime were discovered. Write about a person named Bob Abbott. He's a gas station attendant, and he goes to the restroom and discovers a bloody scene. This is in Andover.
That's correct. Just south on Route 93 from Salem.
So you say it's determined later. It's Leanne Millis's and Kimberly Farah's blood. And now you have Detectives Marchand and Boudet on way to Oxford, Massachusetts to meet with the local police and Massachusetts State Police. And that was about the taking a look at the car and examining the car forensically. Tell us about the German Shepherd and what this canine unit finds.
Well, along they're searching for keys. And Paul, prior to becoming a detective, Paul Marchand, he was a canine officer. So he was very aware of how canines act, particularly on a track. So they went into the woods and the canine alerted started looking up into a tree and then put his front paws on the tree. And the handler said, "Now, come on, let's go." And Paul goes, "Wait a second. He's alerting. There's something up in the tree." So Paul climbed the tree and found the keys to Kimberly's car that the boys had thrown in the woods.
Interesting. Let's get back to the search for these boys. After they are at Deborah Brackel's place, police estimate that they believe that they're still in the area. So how do they proceed and what happens and what reports do they get about the whereabouts of these boys?
Well, the boys went about a mile down the road, and there's a lot of hunting and fishing camps in that area that are, you know, people come and stay a week or maybe a weekend, but they're for the most part deserted. So they pulled up to one place and broke into it. And a neighbor came out and he saw the car and the boys had broken into the place. And he thought he saw people walking inside. So he knows the owner of this hunting cabin, and he calls him and asks, is there supposed to be anyone in your place? And he goes, no. So he called the county sheriffs, who responded. However, the boys had noticed that the neighbor was looking. So they left their car and they went through the woods and maybe half a mile down the road broke into another camp.
So tell us about the moment when they are arrested and the officers that are there and the reaction from the boys themselves.
Well, what we had was they broke into another camp and got a tip they may have been there. So Paul Marchand and Kevin Swift had flown out to Michigan, and they hooked up with Detective Sergeant Dan O'Reilly. So they went to the house, and there was already a state trooper there. And the state trooper said, no, I checked the house and I got nothing. So Paul, again, this was a two-story camp. And again, Paul has very good instincts. He's looking at the house, and all the shades are up except for one window on the second floor. And he points that out to the other guys, and he grabs Dan O'Reilly, and everyone called him Radar O'Reilly after the person on MASH. They go around the house, and there's a window that's broken, and through the broken window, they could reach the doorknob for the door. So what they did was Kevin Swift and Paul secured opposite corners of the house while Dan O'Reilly and a couple state troopers went in. And in the room that the shade was drawn was where they found the three boys.
Right away, you say about Paul Marchand's instincts. Right away, he thinks that he's going to take Grant with him. So they separate the three boys, and Marchand's instinct is to take James Grant with him. Likely with the idea, if there's going to be somebody to confess out of the three, you assess who might be that person. And Marchand instinctively thought James Grant.
That's correct. That's great. He had him in his car, and they're on their way back to the station to get booked. And now he's telling me, you could be in a lot of trouble. But one of you guys is going to confess, and the first one that confesses, I can't promise you anything, but chances are you'll get off a lot lighter than the other two. At that time, New Hampshire did have the death penalty. We no longer have it now.
So despite this warning that he could be in a lot of trouble for not telling the truth and not coming forward first, what does James Grant initially do?
Well, like all the others, he said he's got nothing to say. The boys made up a story that they would tell in the event that they got caught. And the story was, well, Leanne had a boyfriend at the time. And the story they gave was, oh no, it wasn't us. We left the girls before midnight. They were still alive. And Leanne's boyfriend was supposed to come there. And he's probably the one who killed both of them in a jealous rage.
So obviously they have the medical examiner's report. They are doing, as part of the investigation, they're speaking to a lot of people to determine what could be the motive of this incredible double murder. So what do police do with this initial interview? And how cooperative are Chris Doucette and Eric Jelinuski?
Chris Doucette was the toughest one right from the get-go. He gave no indication he was going to say anything or confess, and that was pretty much the case. He didn't do anything. Jelinuski, he went hot and cold. You know, he was, okay, I've got nothing to say, and I know he stuck to the same story. However, the boys had initially not waived extradition because they didn't realize they were going to get a lawyer in New Hampshire, but when it was explained to them that, yeah, you're going to get a lawyer, they waived extradition. And on the way to the airport from the county jail, Radar O'Reilly was driving. He and his partner were in the front seat. Grant was handcuffed in the back, and he says, hey, listen, Grant is saying this. I have to come clean. And Radar says, well, don't talk to us. What you want to do is talk to Paul Marchand, Detective Marchand. And he said the same. Now, he kept saying, I want to come clean over and over again to Marchand when he was out of earshot of the boys. And Paul said, okay, I'm going to contact the attorney general. I can't promise you anything, but as soon as we get to the station, to Salem Police Station, we'll interview you. And the assistant attorney general, Pat Donovan, can give you a deal.
Now, what was the sentences? You talked about the death penalty was available at that time in North Hampshire, but what were the conditions for these guys to be eligible for the death penalty? And what was the others? What was the sentence in New Hampshire at that time for a conviction of first degree murder?
A conviction of first degree murder at that time, you could either get the death penalty or you could get life with no chance of parole. What you need is you need some criteria in order to get the murder punishment. It would either have to be rape or it would have to be killing a cop or killing a congressman. Those were the conditions that were necessary in order to get the death penalty. And there was, in an autopsy that was performed the following day, there was no indication of rape on either girls. So they were going for life without parole. Kimberly's dad really wanted the death penalty. However, it just couldn't be done given New Hampshire law.
Now, Grant agrees to talk, and they want details of what actually happened. So he's able to do that, and he gives a graphic description of what happened that night. First off, he tells about the murder weapon, where it went, and how he got it in the first place. Tell us what he said about the gaining of the murder weapon and things related to this weapon and its use that night.
Well, the murder weapon was a punch knife, and essentially what it is, it's a double-edged knife with a handle on it. And he found it when they were in Leanne's room at her house. The three boys and two girls were there. And he motioned to Jelinowski. And Jelinowski says, yeah, get the knife. And Grant figured, okay, we're going to use this knife in a robbery. He had no idea at the time that it was going to be used in the murder of the two girls.
What did James Grant say in terms of the disposal of that weapon? You write in this book that there was an idea shared by police officers, including yourself, that they might have disposed of the knife in the hedgehog pond. And an experienced scuba diver, you went in search for that and were unsuccessful in finding that weapon in that pond. So I guess it would be very, very crucial information to find out what happened to that murder weapon, according to James Grant.
Well, what happened was the boys went to that mobile station in Andover, Mass. To wash up, and they didn't do a very good job of cleaning up after themselves because there was blood found all over the room. From there, one of the boys was a little familiar with Lawrence Jelinowski, and they drove from Andover east to Lawrence on what was called River Road. They found an industrial park right on the town line between Lawrence and Andover, and they went behind one of the buildings. Jelinowski went into the woods. There was a path right by a basketball court. He went into the woods, and he ended up wrapping the knife in a bloody T-shirt and throwing it into a tree.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. You know what helps me sleep well at night? Physical Gold. I'm concerned about what is going on in America right now and decided to learn more about gold IRAs to help me diversify. You can buy gold for your IRA or your 401k. Gold can't be tracked like digital currency. No one has to know what you're buying. There's no way to print more. My best resource for gold IRAs is Augusta Precious Metals. Their track record is no less than phenomenal. They have thousands of happy customers. They are the absolute best. They are amazing. Learn why thousands of Americans are getting gold IRAs as part of their retirement portfolios. You need to contact Augusta Precious Metals and get their free guide. I'm serious. Text Dan to 68592. Again, text DAN to 68592. Dan at 68592 or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. That's Augusta, AUGUSTA, PreciousMetals.com. Now, they have the idea about the murder weapon, again, in an incredible story about the canine unit, remarkably finding this knife. Tell us about that.
The story that Grant gave us was he gave us directions to the industrial park where they dumped the knife. And he said, we went behind the third or fourth building. And behind that building, there was a basketball court and a brightly colored dumpster. So Detective Fred Riault got together with some Andover detectives, and they went to that industrial park. And the third building on the right did, in fact, have a basketball court and a brightly colored dumpster. There was a Mass State Police canine, and right by the basketball court, there was a path. So the canine started on the path, good doggy, and they came to a tree. And the way Freddie described it, they saw the bloody T-shirt in the tree. It was a long-sleeved T-shirt with one of the arms pointing down. And right under one of the arms pointing down on the ground was the murder weapon.
Part of James Grant's confession was to give the details of the double murder that night. But he also talks about the actual what Eric had said, what Chris had said, what they wanted him to do as being part of this crime. What was part of the confession in terms of his culpability and any semblance of motive of why these women, these two young girls, were killed?
Well, to listen to him talk, he was pushed into it by Jelinowski and Doucette. Jelinowski killed Kimberly Farah maybe a half an hour or so before Leanne was killed. And the boys came over and talked to him, Doucette and Grant. And Jelinowski said, this is how Leanne has to look. So they went back there, and to listen to Grant's confession, he was forced into it, according to him. And he only stabbed Leanne after Doucette had stabbed her repeatedly and killed her. That was his confession initially.
With this confession, we know that he had been threatened with life with no parole. But what was the confession going to get him in terms of a sentence? What was the
deal? It was going to get him 25 years in jail with a chance of parole after that.
Now, based on this, you have to go through a grand jury potential indictment. We can suffice to say that they were successful in the grand jury indictments. Tell us about the grand jury indictments for all three, and before we talk about the trial itself.
All three were indicted. So the deal for Grant was, okay, you got to testify at trial, 25 years with a chance of parole after that. Jelinowski, his lawyer, Andrew Contrupi, who's very well respected amongst cops, not all defense attorneys are, but he's very highly respected, was able to get Jelinowski to confess, to make a confession. And in return for that confession, he would get 37 years to life, but a chance of parole after 37 years. And he was scheduled for trial in April the following year to go before Judge Douglas Gray.
You write that it's not completely unknown, but that a judge rejects a plea. Tell us about this rejection of that plea.
Yeah, that came as a shock to both Andrew Contrupi and Pat Donovan. And at that time, Kelly, this is in April of the following year, Kelly Ayotte is on board too. She eventually became a attorney general and then a state senator in Congress in D.C. Well, anyway, they were both stunned at it about that. When they gave Douglas, Judge Gray, the disposition, he said he would take it under advisement. And one of the things he did was a special hearing with a probation officer who investigated Jelinowski's past. And Gray felt that Jelinowski was getting off too easy, and as a result, he rejected the plea bargain.
Yeah, remarkable. Now, you talk about this. Also, one more complication in this is that Grant's confession before this trial of Eric Jelinowski anyway, and Chris Doucette later, this James Grant's confession changes in a very important way. What is the difference in what he says now, and what was his reason for not telling the truth in the first place, which, as we spoke earlier, that's a big issue that could have kiboshed this whole case?
Absolutely. It was a very dramatic issue. James Grant's trial was in July, the July after Eric Jelinowski's. And after he got his sentence and got the deal, 25 years with a chance of parole, he approached his attorney and changed his story. And the attorney contacted Pat Donovan. And how his story changed was James Grant went from saying that it wasn't Chris Doucette who stabbed her in neck, which was the cause of death. It was me. And the reason why I didn't fess up to it initially, was I was afraid this would squash the deal. Pat Donovan and Kelly Ayotte, as you could imagine, were really surprised about that. And they met and said, okay, we're going to go ahead with this anyway, and we'll see what happens. But they were still fairly confident they could have gotten a conviction either with or without Grant's testimony.
One thing about what Judge Gray said later when he said why he disagreed with the 37-year to life sentence was because of the confession. Now, what we haven't spoken about is the some of the remarkable, incredible things that Eric Jelinuski says during that confession.
Yeah, he was very candid. He showed no remorse whatsoever. It was really amazing. The two people who interviewed him were Detective Mark Sambataro and Roger Baudet, and he was just nonchalant about it. Like, he was describing, a day at the beach.
You talk specifically, he said that he had dragged her away from the fireplace and left her by a door. And they said, detective said, not bothering you much? He said, no. He says, as I was dragging her away, I loved the feeling of the warm, sticky blood flowing through my fingers.
Yeah. At that point, Mark Sambataro, who's a rough and tumble kind of guy, told Roger, go get a cup of coffee. And he turned off the videotape. However, Roger was pretty smart himself. He grabbed Mark and said, okay, I'm getting a cup of coffee, but you're coming with me. And as he's going out of the room, Jelinuski says, yeah, get me a cup too. I'm thirsty. So outside the room, Mark goes to Roger. No, Roger, I want to break his neck. He goes, Roger said, Mark, stand in line. I want to do that too. Okay. So they go back in the room and turn on the video camera again, and they just picked up where they left off. Unfortunately, the discontinuity in the video camera, Judge Gray had a stickler for that. It was a real stickler for that. So Pat Donovan and both Kelly Ayotte felt that, you know what, he may view there could have been some exculpatory item, some exculpatory statement that was said when the video camera was off. So they decided not to use Grant's confession in court because he did confess and was willing to plead guilty to it. That's why they gave him 37 years with the chance of parole. But as we already talked about, Judge Gray threw that out.
Yes. You talk about the media and this story making national news, especially with the tie-in with this movie Scream.
Yep.
And it's the media had headlines like accused viewed horror film and that these two girls were killed for absolutely no reason, an incredibly senseless murder based on this supposed to be a comedic movie.
Exactly. Yeah. How they talk about life imitating art. And that's exactly what it was. It was just, once it's over and done, it's just sad, very sad about it.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So now we got to get to this trial. Obviously, there's only Eric's trial. Tell us about Chris Doucette and Eric's trial and the plea agreements that end up in the end.
Eric's trial, we had a lot of physical evidence tying him to it. There was Eric's fingerprint on her leg when he dragged her. There was fingerprints on the keys. So we had a lot of good physical evidence. We had spatter evidence, blood spatter on his clothes. That was Kimberly's. So there was a lot tying him to the crime. James Grant held up surprisingly well in court under really stiff cross-examination from Andrew Cattrupi. Cattrupi did a good job. I know he tried to impeach his testimony. You've lied before. misjudge your future behaviors, past behavior, you're lying now. But Grant kept his cool and goes, I'm really sorry about this, but it happened and I got to live with it for the rest of my life.
Essentially, what they try to do is to shift the blame to James Grant in both of these trials, and that James Grant did all of the things that they had physical evidence and circumstantial evidence, witness testimony to support the prosecution's claim. The only thing they basically could do was to say that James Grant was the person. And they tried to use as much leverage as possible by the revelation by Grant that he had actually stabbed Leanne Milius in the neck, and that was the cause of death.
That is correct. A very typical defense in a murder trial is to try and place the blame on someone else. And in the three books that I wrote, A Murder at the Front Door and Murder Outside the Back Door, each defendant attempted to do that. And very common. But again, with Jelinowski, there was just so much physical evidence. It was pretty much a no-brainer. And the jury came back with a finding of guilty, and Judge Gray said, okay, life without a chance of parole, and he instructed the bailiffs, get him out of my courtroom. And he said that with quite a bit of vehemence.
You write about a tape that was played in court, and they have Eric Jelinowski saying that, I'm a funny man.
Oh, yeah.
I could do the whole movie if you want. And he was yawning and giggling. And
oh, exactly. Exactly. Again, absolutely no conscience and no remorse. He goes, I'm a real funny man. I'm the funniest man in the world. And he would sometimes imitate Tony Montana in Scarface, like, you know, say hello to my little friend.
Hilarious.
So if anyone deserves to be in jail for life, it is he.
You talk about the jurors. This is not always typical. They were in horror, their hands on their faces over the testimony. The families of the two girls opened weeping in court when they had to be subjected to the details of the murders themselves.
Yeah, it was very explicit. And the crime scene photos were just brutal. There was a tremendous amount of blood. Try not to get into that too much in the book, but it was really very difficult.
Absolutely. You talk about jury deliberations, just a few hours, 5-6 hours to come up with a decision.
Yes. Yeah. I said Pat Donovan and Kelly Ayotte just did a phenomenal job. You know, one of the things about Kelly Ayotte, she went from assistant AG, she went on to be the first female attorney general in New Hampshire. And all throughout her tenure, she never lost a case.
Chris Doucette had an additional charge, conspiracy to commit murder, along with the first degree murder. What was that decision in court?
That they did not have as much physical evidence from Chris as Jelinowski. And so they just added that other charge, and they felt with James Grant's testimony, if worse came to worse and they didn't get a guilty verdict on murder, the conspiracy also carries a very hefty fine, very hefty sentence too. So as it turned out, Doucette was found guilty and also received life in prison without a chance of parole. Should be noted that James Grant is now out on parole and living in Maine.
But he did do his almost 25 years in prison, if not the 20.
That's correct.
Yeah. You talk about updates, but what we hadn't talked about was Mary Wallace and Bill Farah, the parents of the two daughters. What happened with them in the end?
Well, Kimberly and Leanne were really good friends, and both their parents were divorced, and they kind of were trying to fix them up. However, this case brought them together and they eventually got married. Bill was a member of the Elks, and every year the Elks Lodge in Salem, Derry Salem Elks, they sponsor a pool tournament, and the money goes towards scholarship in Kimberly and Leanne's name.
Yeah, tell us more about this memorial scholarship. You talk about they had their first recipient in June 98, but also that Detective Swift and Marchand received a meritorious service award for the countless hours and immeasurable dedication spent in the pursuit of the three murderers of Leanne Milius and Kimberly Farah.
Yeah, that's correct. Both Paul and Kevin had, in previous years, received Officer of the Year award. That's the highest award in Salem Police Department. And Paul received it on two occasions. prior to that. So I thought they should have gotten both officers, should have gotten Officer of the Year. They just did a phenomenal job from soup to nuts. But what the logic was, you know, let's spread around the wealth. We'll give them a very high award, but we'll save the Officer of the Year for someone else right there. But, you know, Paul and Kevin both, no, they're not looking for glory. They just want to do their job, and they both do really good jobs, or did really good jobs. They're now both retired.
Back to the fate of these killers. Chris Doucette behind bars didn't stay quiet. Tell us about additional charges.
You know, I say this all the time. Best judge of future behavior is past behavior. And I think it was 2002. Chris got an additional 10 years on his life sentence for trafficking cocaine inside the prison. And someone from outside who was supplying the cocaine, she was arrested too.
So more than likely, both Doucette and Jelinowski will never see outside of a prison, will they?
Yeah, hopefully they will never see the light of day. If ever two people deserve to be in prison, it is they.
You do an update as well about what happened. We mentioned it, but we can mention it again. Patrick Donovan, 2018, was to serve on the New Hampshire Supreme Court.
That's correct. In writing this book, I spoke to Pat, and no, he just loves being there. He loves his job, and he loves the law, and he just does a great job. Again, couldn't respect Pat more, and also Kelly Ayotte, very highly respected.
Yes, you talk about 2004, she was appointed Attorney General for New Hampshire and the first and only woman to serve as the New Hampshire Attorney General.
That's correct. She went on to be one of the senators in the House of Congress, and she just currently announced in the past week that she is running for governor of the state.
Interesting. You talked about Andrew Cattrupi. He continued premier criminal defense attorney, and he was asked to train other young attorneys, and you say he was respected by police officers and the prosecution.
His office is here in Hampton, where I'm also a part-time police officer. And you know, we'll see him every now and then, and he is still very highly respected. He's got great cases. As a matter of fact, there are a couple cases over the years that police officers have had, and they get him as their attorney. So, again, that's probably very high praise coming from cops on a defense attorney.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about Judge Douglas Gray. It was very interesting that he was also the presiding judge on the Pamela Smart trial. But you say he retired the week after this Jelinowski trial.
Yeah, he did. There was some talk of that. It kind of came somewhat as a surprise. He was talking about retiring. But after this trial, he wanted to spend more time with his grandchildren and more time for himself. And I can't say I blame him.
Yeah, he did make some statement that this was among the worst cases he had presided over, or the one that affected him most.
That is correct. Yeah, that is correct. I would say that this would be a lot worse than the Pam Smart case.
You talk about Detective Paul Marchand retiring in 2006, Detective Kevin Swift in 2011, and Detective Dan O'Reilly retiring in 2009. Before we end this interview, tell us about your friendship with these gentlemen.
Paul, we've been friends since we got on the police department in the early 20s. Paul, Mark, and I lived together for 3 years. I was a bachelor for quite a while. Paul and Mark had just gone through divorces, and we're still in touch. Roger Baudet, same thing. Roger lives a mile away from me here in Hampton. We get together and go golfing. I tell him a lot of times, you know, Roger, you may want to consider fishing as opposed to golf. Paul Marchand, same thing. He lives half a mile from me here in Hampton. And we all go to Florida for at least 3 months in the wintertime. We live within 10 miles of each other in Florida. And we get together for golfing 2-3 times a week and go out for dinner, same amount of time, but lifelong friends. Mark Cavanaugh, too. Mark lives in Florida full time now.
Absolutely. You write at the very end of this book that's what's coming in 2024. Tell us the book that's coming and 2024.
I've started work on that, and it's going to be called Monsters at the Door. And I'm planning on two editions of it. The first one is going to deal, it's going to deal with serial killers, both editions. The first one is going to be two serial killers from Salem, New Hampshire. In 1976, Arlene Boland, a cop's daughter, broke down on the side of the road, and she was killed by a Francis Vercauteren, who had a sordid background and a sordid future. He was eventually arrested, and he escaped twice. He was killed in a barroom fight in St. Thomas 11 years after the second time he escaped. The other one is going to be on the murder of Denise Balfour that occurred in 1987 by a 15-year-old boy who cut off part of her breasts after he murdered her and then had sex with her. And there was, we ended up getting this guy, and he was committed to 35 years in jail. And there was no doubt in my mind, if we didn't arrest him, he was going to be a serial killer, because this is just an urge. I remember one time I'm having a discussion with someone who felt that pedophiles could be cured. And I said, no, that is his nature. If someone's a pedophile, that's his nature. It's just like if a law was passed that in my single days, I couldn't make love to beautiful woman. If that law was passed, I would have become a sex offender.
Yeah,
it is their nature and they cannot change. And then I'm going to have a third story in there on Ted Bundy. And then the second edition will be the most infamous serial killers of our time. I'm looking at Son of Sam in New York and the Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo.
Yeah, we'll be looking forward to that.
Thanks, Dan. I enjoy writing them. It's great.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Murder by the Bathhouse Door, the true story of the murder of two teenage girls by three boys who wanted to play Scream. Thank you so much, John Tomasi. For those that might want to find out more about your other work, do you have a website or do any social media? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I do. My website is johntomasi.com. And on that website, I have the prologues and chapter ones from the three books, Murder at the Front Door, Murder Outside the Back Door, and this book. And the books can be bought on Amazon, either Kindle edition or paperback.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Murder by the Bathhouse Door, the true story of the murder of two teenage girls by three boys who wanted to play Scream. Thank you so much for this interview, John Tomasi, and you have a great evening.
Thanks, Dan. You too.
Good night.